The headlines: Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran will spare no effort to help Lebanon amid the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis. Palestinians denounce an Israeli court decision that grants Jewish worshippers limited right to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. And the World Health Organization approves the use of the world's first vaccine against malaria, the mosquito-borne disease that kills about 500,000 people a year. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic supports Lebanon's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a meeting with the Lebanese president in Beirut. Michel Aoun, for his part, said Lebanon supports efforts aimed at creating convergence among regional countries. Lebanese parliament speaker Nabih Berri also held talks with the top Iranian diplomat. Upon his arrival in Beirut, Amir Abdullahian said Tehran will spare no effort to help Lebanon amid an ongoing economic crisis facing the Mediterranean nation. Earlier, our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh said Iran's assistance would also help Lebanon solve its electricity problems.
Iran has stressed in the past, continues to stress, and today we heard once more from the Iranian foreign minister that Iran is ready to go back to the original initiatives or that they were ready to give to Lebanon, whether it is building new electricity power stations that could really change Lebanon's electricity situation completely, and we can go back to seeing more electricity hours in the country. And that is, one of the main issues. We can have, of course, more issues that are related to the Iranian assistance. And we will see, of course, what happens today with the talks held with Speaker Berri and Prime Minister Najib Mikati.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says that Tehran would remain committed to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal as long as other signatories to the accord keep their side of the bargain. Majid Tahtar Avanchi also called for the removal of sanctions against Iran in a quick and verifiable way. He criticized the noncompliance of some of the parties of the deal, saying the undeniable truth is that the United States and the Europeans have not fulfilled their commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the agreement have tried to salvage the deal since the U.S. withdrew from it and reimposed sanctions on Iran in 2018. Iran's nuclear negotiations, although on life support, will continue even though they have been stalled. Iran's stance has not changed. The lifting of sanctions and the return of the JCPOA agreement, nothing more, nothing less. The U.S., however, based on how Iran sees it, is not sending positive signals, like rejecting Iran's call for the unfreezing of about $10 billion of its money.
Iran has said the United States must effectively remove all 800 illegal sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under former President Donald Trump. Tehran says such a measure serves as a ticket for Washington to return to the negotiating table. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Islamic Republic would definitely resume negotiations with the P4+1 group of countries, including Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany in the Austrian capital Vienna. However, he added, Tehran is still reviewing the details of the 6 rounds of Vienna talks held under the previous Iranian administration. Khatibzadeh said Iran's new administration is currently trying to, quote, find out why the previous talks did not reach a satisfactory phase or a document that all sides will be happy with. He said Tehran is trying to find out the issues that need to be addressed properly in the upcoming talks. The Iranian official said the U.S. is required to remove all the sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump and ensure that Washington will no longer violate the JCPOA. Khatibzadeh also added the new U.S. administration has not changed its policy towards Iran. The sanctions imposed by the Trump administration are in place right now, and we have not seen any meaningful or great change in their policy towards Iran.
As Richard Haass, the head of CFR, has just recently published in Foreign Affairs, there is no difference in practice in foreign policy of President Biden or President Trump. All of them are doing the same thing when it is more serious, so it's beyond the wordplay that each plays. So the point is that the Americans need to realize that they need to be more practical and they need to be more serious about the negotiations.
Hatibzadeh made the remarks amid a pause in Vienna talks between Iranian and P4 plus one delegations on a potential revival of the JCPOA.
Well, Iran has said that the U.S. needs to remove all 800 sanctions imposed after President Trump unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran has also said the U.S. is required to remove all the sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump and ensure that Washington will no longer violate the JCPOA.
Back in September, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, slammed the U.S.'s lack of commitment and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, saying the Islamic Republic is ready for result-oriented talks on the agreement's revival that would secure people's rights and interests. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of the so-called maximum pressure campaign. Following a year of strategic patience, Iran resorted to its legal rights stipulated in Article 26 of the JCPOA, which grants a party the right to suspend its contractual commitments in case of non-compliance by other signatories and let go of some of the restrictions imposed on its nuclear energy program. Meanwhile, the new U.S. administration under President Biden says it wants to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it is showing an overriding tendency for maintaining some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure.
So if they want Iran to be back to the table, if they want Iran to be ready to accept the limitations of the JCPOA, they should actually, the Americans and the Europeans, need to realize that they need to meet their own obligations as well. So Iran is actually entitled to benefit economically from the JCPOA, and
Tehran insists that all sanctions should first be removed in a verifiable manner before the Islamic Republic reverses its counteractive measures. Meanwhile, a high-level Israeli delegation has visited the U.S. over the Iran nuclear deal. The Israeli team has requested that the United States formulate a backup plan in case Iran does not return to talks.
Regarding other scenarios, there are not much options on the table. The Israeli officials are talking about imposing further sanctions, painful sanctions, such things, which we all know that it's nothing but just some bluffing.
Israel has reportedly called on Americans to levy significant and painful sanctions on Iran if it does not sign the deal. Top U.S. officials have also told Israelis that Washington would pursue other venues if diplomacy fails.
Elsewhere, Palestinians have denounced an Israeli court's decision to grant Jewish worshippers the right to perform prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. In a statement, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said it would exert all efforts to challenge the decision. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also decried the ruling, calling it a blatant aggression against Al-Aqsa Mosque. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said the ruling is yet another attempt to divide the holy site in violation of all international laws and norms. Earlier, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement also slammed the decision as invalid. On Wednesday, an Israeli judge in occupied Al-Quds ruled that Israelis' silent prayers at Al-Aqsa could not be considered a criminal act. Our correspondent Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah. Mona, what more can you tell us about this Israeli court's decision?
Well, yes, as you have said, on Wednesday, Israeli judge ruled that silent prayer of the Israeli Jews at the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque cannot be considered a ruled act and is now allowed. This comes because there was an appeal by Israeli Jewish rabbi area, Aleppo, against Israeli police ban that were not allowing him to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and to pray there. We have to make it clear that Israeli settlers raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound frequently. However, they are not allowed to pray there because the compound houses the Dome of the Rock, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Clashes continue to take place against the entering or the visits by the Israeli settlers to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Now, with allowing the settlers to pray inside the compound, Palestinians, Muslims there would be clashing with the Israeli settlers that, of course, would be protected by the Israeli forces in order not to allow these prayers to take place and not to discredit the Muslim holy site. The Palestinian government, the Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh, condemned this decision and warned Israel against more attempts to impose new facts on the ground inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's, of course, a warning from a new could be a religious war if this would be allowed, allowing settlers to pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
And what about the international response to this violation?
Well, of course, Palestinians are demanding international position because they know that just allowing the Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is illegal. However, now while allowing the settlers to pray there, then Palestinians are in need for action, not only condemnations from the international community or the European Union. Palestinians are hoping that the EU and the international community would be forcing the Israeli regime not to allow this new policy to take place in order to avoid any new religious war between Muslims or Palestinians and Israelis inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and in Al-Quds as well.
All right, thanks a lot, Monab Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, the World Health Organization has endorsed the use of the world's first and only approved malaria vaccine for children, calling it a breakthrough.
Today, WHO is recommending the broad use of the world's first malaria vaccine. This recommendation is based on results from an ongoing pilot program in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi that has reached more than 800,000 children since 2019. This long-awaited malaria vaccine is a breakthrough for science, child health, and malaria control.
The WHO says a vaccine developed by British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline should be widely given to African children at risk. The endorsement of RTSS, or Mosquirix vaccine, follows a decade of clinical trials in seven African countries. Since 2019, some 2.3 million doses have been administered to infants in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. According to the UN Health Agency, 94% of malaria cases and deaths occur in Africa. It is deadlier than COVID-19 on the continent and claimed 386,000 lives in 2019, compared to 212,000 coronavirus deaths in the past 18 months there. The mosquito-borne disease kills about 500,000 people worldwide every year. Russia has logged over 27,500 new COVID-19 infections, its highest daily caseload this year. The government's coronavirus task force also confirmed 924 COVID-related deaths for the past day. The figure is just a little shy of Wednesday's record one-day toll of 929. Russia has the highest number of deaths from the virus in Europe, with over 213,000 fatalities. It's also the second hardest-hit country on the continent in terms of infections, with nearly 7.7 million cases. Russia has been grappling with the third wave of the pandemic for the past few months. The surge is blamed on the Delta variant of the virus, the government's reluctance to tighten restrictions, and people's rejection to get vaccinated. Less than 30% of the adult population has been fully vaccinated. And at least 20 people have been killed in an earthquake that rocked Pakistan's southwestern Baluchistan province. Most of the victims died after roofs and walls collapsed as they were asleep. Nearly 300 others have also been injured. Pakistan's disaster management officials say The toll may increase. According to the U.S. Geographical Survey, the Tembler was 5.7 magnitude. It struck at about 3 a.m. local time at a depth of about 20 kilometers. The quake was felt in provincial capital Quetta and other cities in Balochistan. An estimated 200,000 people have demonstrated against economic austerity in France after unions called the first nationwide strike since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Major cuts to unemployment insurance are set to go into effect despite widespread economic uncertainty and continually increasing inequality. Rami Mazari reports from Paris.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began. But we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masoud Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know. And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do. Nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it doesn't. It's not really a kind of comprehensive look at this situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk, and of course his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him, and he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So it's, and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved, but some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masoud, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, as the film was about the franchise sort of youth, getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what is sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. Well, in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost.
You know? You're saying there's multiple messages in this film.
It is, but yeah. I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and yeah. I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so remember, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them, and out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that is something.
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon, and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of, did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and of nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know.
That's
and I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam. Well, and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look at the vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are an easy target for Al-Shabaab because the person's mind is already crafted and created, you know, in his own mind. He doesn't trust the police, but the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like me. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable thing to feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in a real sense for the right thing, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
Mm. And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. You know, they're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do. And it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it it is a short film, and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's
story.
A merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, you know, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, you know, and I saw that it was wrong, you know, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into just endless killing. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be, I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done
in the film,
anything
does it,
illegal?
Does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me. And I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story.
And maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masu, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that, it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of the society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about. And I kind of wish it had, but then that's another film, so. Mm-hmm.
And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long and it raises many questions, but as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about how immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We're trying to look at things that concerns human rights. There's one particular thing I would like to look at, something that we refer to in Arabic as Hulful Fubul, as a treaty the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi gave to the Muslims, called a sermon, something he delivered to the Muslims when he was doing his final pilgrimage from Mecca. And itself, it might sound like as advices or rules being said by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. But the fact is, it talks about what things that we must preserve when it comes to humans and humanity. So it's a very important treaty, a very important sermon that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi having spoke about. I will try to first go through it as a whole, and inshallah maybe in episodes to come we can discuss it further and further. So he said, O people, do you know in which month you are in, and which day you are in, and which place you are in? So they said to him, obviously the day is the day of Haram. It's a forbidden day because it was during Hajj. They said in the month which is forbidden, which is the month of Hajj itself, so one cannot kill or anything in this day. And in a Baladun Haram, a forbidden country as well, so the land of Mecca during Hajj, one cannot hunt, one cannot kill, one cannot do a lot of things are forbidden. So the month is sacred, the day is sacred, and the place, the land they are in is sacred. Then the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he said the following, he said, فَإِنَّ دِمَاءَكُمْ وَأَمْوَالَكُمْ وَأَعْرَاضَكُمْ عَلَيْكُمْ حَرَامٌ. Your blood, your wealth, and your woman are forbidden on each other to spill, to take, and to commit adultery. So this is basically the pillars of a human rights foundation, where under no circumstances do anyone have the right to shed the blood of another human being. Under no circumstances, as we will go in further details and we'll see what that means from an Islamic perspective. When it comes to the wealth and the possessions of others, can I and you take them? Can I and you feel free to help ourselves to others' possessions and properties? Obviously not. That is also forbidden in Islam, which also means that your rights are maintained when it comes to your property. And when it comes to your family, when it comes to your woman, when it comes to your children, they are also protected. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi is saying, as much as the land of Mecca is sacred, the month of the Hajj is considered to be a sacred month, and the days of the month of the Hujjah is sacred, so are these things that no one should go and break and, you know, do as he wishes. So that's just the bottom line, that's the pillar, the foundation of the Islamic human rights that sadly are not maintained in today's world, where in today's world you see people raging war just so they could take the possessions of others, be it land, be it oil, or be it something they fancy. And it's okay for them to invade another country and take women and children as captives, prisoners and slaves, and so on and so forth. These things, Islam has put a stop on it, that you cannot do so. Let us take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at the rest of the treaty or the sermon of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi.
Do Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, to the program for humanity. We are continuing with the sermon of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam that he delivered on his final pilgrimage from Mecca. And he stated a few things we mentioned. Now he says, and he repeats this phrase three times, which means it's very important. He says, Ala la tadlimu, Ala la tadlimu, Ala la tadlimu. Indeed, do not oppress. Do not oppress. Do not oppress. And he used the word dhulm, oppression, because that word in Arabic, it encompasses everything that there is to be included. So any form of oppression that you can think of, it will fall under this word. So taking the right of other people, that's oppression. Silencing people to say the truth, this is oppression. Not letting people, for example, exercise their right to raise their voice and their concerns is also oppression. So oppression takes so many forms. So whatever thing that could come to your mind that indicates oppression, the Prophet has it included in the word, do not oppress. Allah la tadlimu, do not oppress. And basically that word itself sums up everything for us as human beings when it comes to dealing with other people. That I should not oppress them in any way, shape, or form. Even sometimes if, let's say, I swear at you or curse you or hurt you verbally, that's a form of oppression. Yet alone try to take your position, your property, or kill you. So this is how sensitive Islam is when it comes to the fact that human rights need to be maintained. Then the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, he continues and he says, إِنَّهُ لَا يَحُلُّ مَا لِمْرِئٍ إِلَّا بِطِيبِ نَفْسٍ مِنْهِ. That when it comes to the wealth and property of others, you should not take them, you should not touch them. The only reason or the only time there's an exception to that formula where one can take the possession and property of others is when the other party agrees. So let me put this in an example we can understand. If I had a farm and my farm was, you know, had fruits and stuff like that, and some people sometimes, be it poor or not, they come to my farm and they take from these fruits. Now, if I don't mind, if it is okay with me to take, then obviously, under this circumstances, I'm cool with it. They don't need to ask me for permission, they don't need to ask. But if they don't, if I'm not happy with it, if I don't allow people to come and take from my farm, then that's considered to be stealing. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam says, if you as a person content, happy with people taking things that belong to you, by all means. But he says, if that person does not have this in himself, then don't do it. Which is another moral lesson the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam is trying to teach me and you, that I would leave for another day. So when you see, these are few points that I've mentioned in the sermon without discussing it in details, which inshallah we will look at later on, that proves to you how sensitive Islam is when it comes to the human rights. We'll leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.